He wasn't just fast, he made time Neo. From a barefoot boy racing goats through the hills of Jamaica, to the world's greatest sprinter who danced before the gun and smiled through the storm. Usain Bolt didn't just break records, he rewrote what humans believed was possible. But behind the gold medals and roaring stadiums lies a deeper story of pain, pressure, failure, and faith. This is not just the tale of a man who ran faster than anyone in history. This is the legacy of lightning and what happens when it stops. Welcome to the History of the Caribbeans podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Usain Bolt, A Journey Through Time, Episode 1. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, Lightning in the Hills. The village of Sherwood Content lay nestled in the Emerald Hills of Trelawney Parish, Jamaica, a quiet, whispering place where the wind rustled banana leaves like gossip, and the sun spilled gold over zinc rooftops and dusty footpaths. There were no neon signs, no traffic lights, no towers clawing at the sky, only the pulse of nature, the laughter of children, and the rhythm of life beating slow and strong like a reggae bassline. And it was here, in this small, unassuming village, that a boy was born who would one day move faster than the world thought possible. But on August 21, 1986, he was just Usain, a long-limbed newborn with curious eyes and lungs that filled the hills with sharp, insistent cries. His mother, Jennifer Bolt, cradled him with a quiet reverence. A kind woman with steady hands and a mind for order. She believed in discipline, prayer, and three square meals a day. His father, Wellesley Bolt, stood by her side, solid as the earth. Wellesley owned the local grocery store, a modest tin roof shack that sold everything from flour to batteries. He was a man of few words, but when he spoke, even the goats seemed to listen. Usain was their youngest child, their unexpected blessing. From early on, there was something electric about him. Not loud or brash, just alive in a way that made people pause. As a toddler, he ran before he walked. Before most babies learned to crawl, Usain had figured out how to fling open the front door and race barefoot down the red dirt lane, chasing dragonflies, goats, or sometimes nothing at all. "Messiah, keep up with him," Jennifer used to say, laughing but exasperated. Like a little bolt of lightning, that one. The nickname stuck, Lightning. But back then, it was just a joke among villagers, murmured over domino tables or shouted from porches as Usain tore past in a blur of limbs. No one imagined what it would one day mean. Life in Sherwood Content was slow, but not idle. Mornings began with rooster crows and the metallic clang of machetes as farmers cut paths through sugarcane. The school children in crisp uniforms walked miles to class, lunch tins swinging, voices echoing over hilltops. Rain came in short, defiant bursts, soaking the earth before vanishing just as quickly. And after school, the hills came alive with the sounds of play, soccer balls kicked across makeshift fields, laughter ringing off the valley walls, and often the quick pat-pat-pat of bare feet racing downhill. That was where Usain lived, between rain and sunlight, in the space where boys turned dirt roads into racetracks. He loved soccer more than anything, idolizing players like Ruud van Nistelrooy and Roberto Carlos. He would spend hours kicking stones at makeshift goals made from old coconut trunks, his long legs an awkward tangle of potential. But even then, something else shimmered beneath the surface. By the time he entered Waldensia Primary School, the other kids knew better than to challenge him to a foot race. It wasn't just that he won, he floated. When Usain ran, it was like the wind caught him under the ribs and lifted him into motion. The others would pump their arms and grit their teeth, but Usain, he laughed. He ran like it was a game, like the world existed only to be outrun. His teachers noticed. So did the principal. But it was Mr. Nugent, his physical education coach, who first saw the storm forming behind that easy smile. "He's got something rare," Mr. Nugent told Jennifer one evening, wiping sweat from his brow. "Raw speed, sure. But he runs like he's already dreaming of something bigger." Jennifer smiled politely, but she didn't let her hopes fly too high. Trelawney was full of dreamers. Most ended up back where they started, She wanted her son to be grounded, disciplined, educated. Running? That was a hobby, not a future. Still, there were moments that made her pause. Like the time Usain came home with a crumpled certificate from a school race he had won. He didn't even mention it until she found it in his backpack. Or the time he chased down a soccer ball half a mile downhill, overtaking boys 3 years older without breaking a sweat. Or the time he stood on the ridge behind their house, arms wide, as if waiting for lightning to strike. Usain wasn't like other children. He was endlessly curious, always moving, and hilariously confident. He would tell anyone who listened that he was going to be the best at something. He just hadn't figured out what yet. "I might be a cricketer," he said once, mimicking Brian Lara's batting stance with a stick in the backyard. "Or maybe football. Or a superhero. Yeah, maybe that." Jennifer rolled her eyes, but inside her chest, something fluttered. It was Coach Dwayne Jarrett at William Nibb Memorial High School who finally lit the match. Jarrett didn't just see speed, he saw focus. He saw a young man who didn't yet realize how powerful he was. And he was determined to sharpen that raw energy into something unstoppable. At first, Usain resisted. He still saw running as a side act to his true love, cricket. But Jarrett was patient. He offered training sessions that felt more like play, races that rewarded fun as much as form. Slowly, the boy began to change. He grew taller, almost freakishly tall for a sprinter. His stride lengthened, his body leaned. His mind, once scattered like marbles, began to settle. Then came the school championship, a 200-meter sprint against boys who had been training harder, longer, with more to prove. Usain didn't just win. He left them behind. The crowd erupted, not because he won, but because he soared. His classmates swarmed the track, hoisting him up, calling his name like a prophecy. And somewhere in the back of the crowd, Jennifer watched with misty eyes. She knew now. Whatever this gift was, it wasn't hers to contain. It had taken root. It had begun to bloom. Sherwood content would always be his beginning, but something bigger had called his name. The boy who once raced goats down dirt roads now had the world chasing him. And the hills of Jamaica, quiet, swaying, timeless, had just birthed a storm. Chapter 2. The Boy Who Ran Like the Wind. By the time Usain turned 10, his legs seemed to move faster than his thoughts. There was a wildness to his running, a kind of beautiful, untrained chaos that made people stop and stare even when they didn't know what they were looking at. He didn't run like he was chasing a finish line. He ran like he was trying to leave the world behind. At Waldentia Primary School, he quickly became both a marvel and a mystery. Teachers knew him as the child who couldn't sit still, the one always asking if recess could start early, or if he could just do one more lap around the field before math class. Students saw him as the untouchable king of playground races. No one dared challenge him anymore, not seriously. They'd line up next to him on a dare, but they all knew how it would end. With dust in their mouths and Usain already halfway down the field, arms spread like wings. There was no form, no technique. He didn't need it. His legs were long and loose, his stride awkward but fluid, like a kite barely tethered to the earth. He looked like he could lift off if the wind hit just right. But it wasn't just his speed. It was the joy in it. Usain didn't run for medals. He ran for mischief, for thrill, for the way the air hit his face and filled his lungs, for the way the world blurred around him and made him feel like he was flying. Every race was an escape. Every sprint was a story written in footsteps. And soon, his stories started reaching beyond Sherwood content. The inter-school sports competitions were where Usain first tasted real competition, and even then, the taste was sweet. Coaches from other schools raised eyebrows when they saw him step onto the track, gangly, relaxed, barely looking like he belonged in spikes. "Too tall for a sprinter," they whispered. "He looks lazy," others muttered. But seconds later, all their assumptions would vanish in the wake of his stride. Usain didn't just win, he demolished. And still he would laugh afterward, grinning ear to ear, tugging at his jersey, asking if there was time for a quick football match before the ride back home. Mr. Nugent, his PE teacher, was the first to recognize the glimmer of something extraordinary. he began keeping records, jotting down times that seemed impossible for a boy that age. "I think we have something here," he told the principal one afternoon. Not just fast gifted, but Jennifer Bolt wasn't quite ready to buy into the idea that her son might be destined for greatness. She saw a child who loved snacks more than vegetables, who sometimes forgot to tie his shoelaces, who'd rather play FIFA on a friend's console than practice darts and finishes. "He's just a boy," she'd say, folding laundry with a shake of her head. "A boy who runs fast." Still, even she couldn't deny that something unusual was happening. At the parish championships in Falmouth, Usain faced the best runners from across Trelawney, kids who had been training formally for years, wearing polished shoes and matching kits. Usain showed up in scuff sneakers and socks that didn't match, looking more like a boy heading to the shop than someone about to run a race. But when the starter pistol fired, all of that vanished. The crowd fell silent, then roared as he pulled ahead by several strides. Coaches from Kingston scribbled notes. One even approached Nugent after the race. "What club does he run for?" the coach asked. "He doesn't," Nugent replied, still beaming. "He runs for fun." But that would soon change. News of the barefoot boy from Sherwood Content began to spread. There were whispers about national potential, about Jamaica's next big star. And with each new competition, Usain seemed to grow, not just in size, though he sprouted like bamboo, but in spirit. He began to understand that his speed wasn't just a party trick. It was a weapon, a gift, a calling. He still played football, still joked around and made faces during warm-ups. But there was something new in his eyes before a race. Focus. Not fierce or heavy, but present. Like a flame learning how to burn. At home, Wellesley tried to keep things normal. He still made Usain sweep the yard, still gave him long lectures about responsibility when he left chores undone. Jennifer made sure homework came before track meets. Fame, if it was coming, would not change their house. They were a humble family, raised on routine and hard work, and they intended to keep it that way. But deep down, both parents were beginning to wonder, what if? What if the stories were true? What if the path their son was running didn't end in Sherwood Content, but led out into the world? One afternoon, after a particularly dominant performance at a regional meet, Coach Dwayne Jarrett from William Nibb Memorial High School paid a visit. He sat at the Bolt family's table, sipping juice and talking quietly with Wellesley and Jennifer about training regimens, nutrition, opportunity. "He has it," Jarrett said. "The it you can't teach. The kind you only see once every few decades." Jennifer listened, nodding slowly. She didn't say much, but after Jarrett left, she found Usain sitting on the back steps, legs stretched out, chin tilted toward the sky. "You really want this?" she asked. He shrugged. "I dunno, Mama. I like running." She nodded. "Then run. But run with purpose. Not just with your feet. Run with your head." He didn't understand her then. Not fully. But those words would echo through him in the years to come. At William Nibb, the pace of life changed. The training was harder. The coaches stricter. The expectations heavier. And for the first time, Usain felt pressure pressing down on his easy stride. He was no longer the fastest by default. He had to prove himself, refine himself, shape himself into something more. But even under the weight of discipline, he never lost his spark. He cracked jokes during drills. He danced during stretches. He made fun of his friends, of himself, of everything and nothing. And when it came time to run, he ran like no one else could, like he was still chasing dragonflies down red dirt roads. One day, during a 400-meter race, Jarrett watched as Usain sprinted past the finish line and kept going, grinning wildly, arms raised to the sky. "He doesn't run like a sprinter," one assistant coach said. "No," Jarrett replied. "He runs like he's already free." That day, they timed him unofficially. The numbers startled them. It was faster than many national juniors. And Usain hadn't even broken a sweat. The pieces were coming together. The boy who once ran because he could now ran because he must. And somewhere inside him, something was shifting, an understanding that the world might be bigger than Jamaica, and his role in it might be greater than just winning races. He was still a boy, but soon he would become a force. The wind didn't know it yet, but it had competition. Chapter 3, From Crooked Dreams to Sprinting Fate. Before there were finish lines, gold medals, or roaring stadiums with flags waving like fire in the wind, there was a boy with a cricket bat made from an old broomstick, barefoot on a patchy field behind his high school, swinging for the sky. If you asked him back then what he wanted to be, he wouldn't have said Olympic champion. He wouldn't have mentioned world records. He would have shrugged, pushed his braided hair from his forehead, and said with a gleam in his eye, "Me want be like Brian Lara." Usain Bolt, tall, skinny, all knees and elbows, wanted to play cricket. Not just for fun, not just after class, but professionally, passionately, fully. Cricket was more than a sport to him. It was a dream that had weight, rhythm, legacy. He loved the drama of it, the pause before the bowlers run up, the crack of bat against ball, the explosion of cheers after a six. It was strategy and style. It was swagger. And when he watched the West Indies play on TV, something stirred inside him. Not the reckless thrill of a short sprint, but the deep hum of respect and desire. He practiced batting against friends every afternoon after classes at William Nibb Memorial High School, often barefoot, always smiling. His wrists were quick, his timing uncanny. And when he bowled, there was already a fluid grace in his movement, a rhythm that looked effortless but was built on instinct. Coaches at the school saw it too. He had potential. He wasn't just fast, he was talented. And because he was taller than most boys his age, he had an advantage both on the pitch and in the minds of those who still thought sprinting was for the short and muscular. But fate, real fate, isn't always loud. Sometimes it walks in quiet, wearing no shoes, disguised as routine. And for Usain, fate wore the face of a PE teacher with a keen eye and a calm voice. Mr. Pablo McNeil, a former Jamaican Olympic sprinter turned coach, had been watching Usain during training, not just during sprints, but in the way he moved when he thought no one was looking. There was a looseness to his body that reminded McNeil of something he'd only seen once or twice in his life. It wasn't just natural talent. It was untamed velocity. One humid afternoon, after a long training session for a school track meet, McNeil called him over. "Bolt," he said, leaning on the fence. "You ever think about taking this running thing seriously?" Usain laughed, wiping sweat from his brow. "Me just run fi fun, sir. Cricket a me sport." McNeil nodded slowly, smiling in that way adults do when they know the answer before you do. "Maybe," he said. "But cricket na mek the wind move like you do." Usain didn't say anything. But that night, as the crickets chirped and the hills glowed in the moonlight, he lay awake, staring at the ceiling, turning that sentence over in his mind. "Cricket na mek the wind move like you do." What did that even mean? The next few months became a quiet tug of war between two versions of himself. There was the boy who dreamed of the pitch, who could recite cricket stats by heart, and whose room had a poster of Brian Lara on the wall. And then there was the other boy, the one who felt something primal ignite in his chest when his feet struck the track, who began to crave that quiet hush before a race and the roar that came after. Coach Dwayne Jarrett began to see the change too. He noticed that Usain's once playful warm-ups started carrying intention. His form was improving. His posture tightened. His curiosity grew. Jarrett understood the moment he had to strike was coming. He knew Usain was still hesitant, still clinging to cricket like a child holds onto the last piece of childhood before stepping into the unknown. So one day, he did something unexpected. He arranged a meeting, not with a coach, not with an athlete, but with a legend. Herb McKinley, Jamaican sprinting royalty and Olympic medalist, had long been a guiding force in the island's athletics. And when he met Usain, he didn't speak with grandeur or arrogance. He simply said, "Son, you can either be good at something you love or become great at something the world has never seen before." Usain didn't answer right away. He didn't have to. The seed had been planted. His next race was a 200-meter dash in a regional high school meet. There were cameras, scouts, even journalists present. It was the first time he saw his name printed in a program. It made his stomach flutter, made the ground feel a little less steady. The crowd was thick with chatter. Coaches eyed the lanes, parents gripped the chain-link fences. The sun poured heat onto the track, and when Usain stepped into his lane four, he felt every eye on him. Not the usual laughter, not the playful teasing from his classmates. Expectation, and then silence. Set, bang. He exploded out of the blocks, awkwardly at first, too tall, too lanky. But by the 50-meter mark, he'd found rhythm. His knees lifted higher, his shoulders dropped, his arms sliced the air like sails in a storm. And as he came around the bend, something happened. Time slowed. Not literally, not in the physics sense, but emotionally. The crowd blurred, the noise dimmed. All that existed was the lane ahead and the wind behind him. He crossed the finish line in a time that stunned the crowd. People didn't cheer right away. They blinked, checked their watches, looked around in disbelief. He had shattered the meet record. When his name was announced, the applause came like thunder, delayed but overwhelming. Usain walked off the track in a daze, not out of exhaustion, but transformation. He just felt it. That thing. That click. The moment when a person meets their purpose and the world shifts to make room for it. From that day on, cricket remained a love, a passion, a memory. But sprinting? Sprinting became the mission. And soon, it would become the fire that would burn trails across continents. The next few months flew by in a blur of races, training, sore muscles, laughter, and growth. Usain began to read more about sprinting legends, Don Corey, Carl Lewis, Michael Johnson. He studied videos, mimicked their posture in front of the mirror. He took note of form, of breathing, of every millisecond that could separate the great from the good. But even as his body changed and his focus sharpened, one thing stayed the same. He ran with joy, with lightness, with the kind of freedom only someone who once chased dragonflies on red dirt roads could understand. There was no longer any doubt. The boy who had once wanted to play cricket for the West Indies was destined to run for the world. And the world was about to learn his name. Chapter 4. Trials of the Teenage Thunder. The spotlight does not wait for permission. It doesn't knock gently or introduce itself with warning. It crashes down like floodlights on a darkened stage, blinding, sharp, unforgiving. And when it landed on Usain Bolt, he was barely 15 years old. At an age when most boys were still navigating acne, voice cracks, and their first dances, Usain was being summoned to carry the weight of a nation's expectations. Jamaica had always loved its sprinters, but now it was beginning to believe it had found a prodigy. A boy who ran like he was pulled by the ancestors. A boy with legs too long and steps too smooth to be ordinary. The pressure didn't arrive all at once. It came in trickles. Questions from journalists, invitations from track clubs in Kingston, glances from strangers who now seemed to recognize him in grocery stores and gas stations. But when the invitations started arriving from outside Jamaica, when international meets began penciling his name into starting lineups before he had even confirmed, it became clear. Usain's childhood was ending. And fast. In 2002, Jamaica hosted the World Junior Championships in Kingston, and for the first time, the country looked inward not just for participation, but for victory. All eyes were on Bolt, then just 15, lanky and shy, still growing into his 6-foot frame. He wore his nerves like a second skin, fidgeting before interviews, laughing too loud, slouching as if to make himself smaller than the expectations piling onto his back. But on the track, he was thunder-wrapped in teenage limbs. He lined up for the 200-meter final, his heart a war drum in his chest. He stared down the track not at the finish line, but at the thousands of Jamaicans packed into the national stadium, horns blaring, flags waving, their cheers a single, rising voice that called him home. And then bang, he ran like a fuse had been lit. It wasn't the cleanest race of his life. His form was loose, arms too wide, head wobbling slightly. But none of that mattered, because he won. Not just the race, but history. Usain Bolt became the youngest ever gold medalist in the World Junior Championships. At 15, a child, now crowned a global champion, the stadium exploded, not just with applause, but with belief. In that moment, Jamaica's dreams weren't just pointed at him. They were placed on him. But what no one saw, what no camera captured, was how much that victory would cost. Fame is a crown with thorns. In the months that followed, Usain's life was no longer his own. Interviews, appearances, ceremonies. People began speaking about him like he was already a legend, already a man. But inside, he was still a teenager, torn between duty and desire, discipline and distraction. He wanted to train, but he also wanted to play video games with his friends. He wanted to make his country proud, but he also wanted to sleep and sometimes skip morning laps, laugh without guilt. And behind the curtain of stardom, his body began to betray him. The growth spurts that had once given him an edge now came with searing pain. His spine twisted slightly from the rapid stretching of his frame. He began suffering from scoliosis, a curvature of the spine that brought with it muscle imbalances and shooting pain in his lower back and legs. Coaches pushed him harder, believing that with more training, he could push through. But the pain lingered like a shadow, stealing his focus, dulling his joy. Then came the whispers. Maybe he peaked too early. He doesn't have the discipline. He's just hype, no substance. They said it in training camps, in newspaper columns, in anonymous online forums. And worst of all, they said it in Jamaica, the place that had once lifted him on its shoulders. The world loves a prodigy, but it demands a prophet. And when a prodigy falters, even just a little, the silence becomes thunderous. Usain tried to keep smiling through it all. He cracked jokes at press conferences. He danced before races. But behind closed doors, he was confused, hurting, and tired. He didn't know how to ask for help. He didn't want to seem weak. He didn't want to disappoint. In 2004, he qualified for the Athens Olympic Games, an honor that should have been a culmination, a dream realized. But he arrived in Greece nursing a hamstring injury and carrying the ghosts of self-doubt on his shoulders. The 200-meter race, the event he had once dominated, became a battlefield. He lost in the first round. Just like that. No medal. No glory. No lightning. Just silence. Jamaican media turned cold. Some called him a wasted talent. Others suggested he should have stuck to cricket after all. People who once cheered his name now questioned whether he had ever been that special in the first place. But in the background, quiet, watchful, stood a man who saw something different. Coach Glenn Mills had been observing Bolt for years. A father figure to many of Jamaica's best sprinters, Mills was a man of discipline, wisdom, and strategy. Where others saw a fading star, Mills saw a masterpiece that hadn't yet been sculpted. After Athens, Mills approached him, not with judgment, but with vision. "You're not finished," he told him plainly. "You've barely started." Usain wasn't sure he believed it. But deep down, some part of him wanted to. Pain became his teacher. Doubt became his fuel. Under Coach Mills, things began to change. Slowly. Quietly. First, they focused on healing. Mills pulled him from major competitions, encouraging recovery over results. He brought in physiotherapists, rebuilt his training schedule, restructured his diet, and most importantly, restructured his mind. He taught Bolt that greatness wasn't born in medals. It was born in mornings when you didn't want to get up, in laps run with aching legs, in races where no one was watching but you ran like they were. He reminded him that humility was not weakness. It was the foundation of strength. Usain listened, not because he had no other choice, but because for the first time someone believed in the man he could become, not just the boy he had been. The world had started to forget him, but he had begun to remember himself. By the end of his teenage years, Usain was no longer a golden boy with raw talent. He was a young man with scars, with discipline, with purpose. He had faced fame too early and failure too deeply. And through it all, he hadn't quit. Because buried beneath the injuries, the headlines, and the pain was still that barefoot boy chasing dragonflies on a red dirt road. The boy who once ran because he could, not because he had to. Now, he was learning to run with intention, not just to escape, not just for glory, but because he had something to prove, not to the world, to himself.